This is the Irrationally Exuberant. I'm Reed Messerschmidt.
1997 was a strange year, as are all years, really. We live in an unlikely world that defies all sense and reason. But the strangeness of 1997 was amplified by two things in particular. The approaching end of the 20th century, millennial transitions always bring out the doomsayers, and the appearance of a massive comet streaking across the night sky, more visible and to a larger portion of the world's population than any comet in recorded history. And that wasn't all. Turned out, the Hale-Bopp comet was being trailed by a massive spaceship piloted by a new incarnation of the soul that had once, on Earth, inhabited the body of a stocky, middle-aged woman named Bonnie Lou Nettles. And that soul, shockingly, was what Earthlings call God the Father. God, nay, Bonnie, was here to pick up her son, in a manner of speaking, Marshall Applewhite, the current home for the soul that had once inhabited Jesus Christ, as well as 38 of Marshall's followers, members of what has come to be known as the Heaven's Gate suicide cult. This rendezvous to the public looked a lot like 39 confused weirdos in identical Nikes and tracksuits killing themselves in a California bungalow by eating poison pudding and drinking vodka, but it wasn't. It was the God on a UFO thing. Unfortunately, I was but 14 for most of that year and too busy obsessing over my feelings and my penis and Eddie Vedder's lyrics to join them. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. This all began in 1972 when a closeted homosexual choir director met a nurse in a psych ward, and their meat suits were inhabited by the Son of God and God, respectively. Their names were Marshall Herf Applewhite and Bonnie Lou Nettles. Everyone called Applewhite Herf, which seems like an unlikely nickname for the vessel of Christ, but what do I know? The two, as they would come to be known, had similar interests and non-sexual sparks flew. Those interests were, primarily, Christianity, UFOs, general enlightenment, and smocks. It's difficult to say when the two were officially inhabited by the next-level beings that squatted in their disgusting human flesh costumes, but it could very well be the first time that they laid eyes on each other, as this meeting was prophesied in Revelations 11, verses 3 through 12, which they would often refer to in the coming years. As it was so central to the formation of their belief systems, I'll use it as a framework and compare it to how things actually played out. It didn't exactly go the way Revelation said, as we'll see, but that's hardly the fault of the two. The Bible is filled with typos, exaggerations, and whimsies. Revelations 11, verse 3.
And I will give power unto my two witnesses, and they shall prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth.
So obvious. Two. They were two people, and what was stopping them from making some prophecies? Nothing. Applewhite and Nettles were very different in a lot of ways. She was as thoughtful and enigmatic as he was wild-eyed and charismatic, but they had two key things in common. First and most important, they were seekers, dissatisfied with the world and desperate for some meaning. This is hardly unique, but they took it, you know, slightly further than most do. I, for instance, tend to read books like The Denial of Death and give the establishment the old stink eye while attempting to live happily and authentically within its framework, while they chose to proclaim themselves extraterrestrial saviors and ultimately led a few dozen folks to a highly public mass suicide. But the idea is the same. The second similarity is that they both came from a Christian background, and that's the lens they chose to filter all of their out-there ideas through. So, their ideas, the prophecies. They are a bit dense and take years of study under the tutelage of an older member, one or both of the two, but I'll do my best to summarize them for you. The logical entrance point, I think, is Jesus Christ, the raggedy Jewish fellow from 2,000-ish years ago who said some nice things about treating other people well and did some magic and got nailed to a cross, as the story goes. Turns out he was also merely a meat receptacle for the evolutionary level above human, what we would call a highly evolved alien race that, for reasons that are still a little foggy to me, travel around to inhabit planets and plant soul deposits into various mammals, then leave, then send a representative to those planets to inhabit one of the mammals, previously designated for this purpose, and it's that soul and mammal body's job, butthole and divine knowledge and all, to go around and recruit as many of the other meat suits with soul deposits as he or she can and train them to shed their earthly shackles so their souls can get picked up by a massive spaceship and brought back to where they belong, to live with the other members of the evolutionary level above humans in new, non-gendered bodies that don't have any of the unbearable quirks of mammalian bodies, like the need to chew and rot and stink and shit out of those buttholes I mentioned. You'd think, since they're so powerful, that they could just stay home and make some already great entities with what they've got lying around, but again, what do I know? I'm not even sure I've got a soul deposit. Like I said, this is all pretty complicated. So, theoretically, only the meat suits with soul deposits are able to recognize the representative of the evolutionary level above human, or as I'll call it from now on, Ella, and they will either flock to him or her or cling to their earthly ways, like amassing dress shirts and Tupperware and having orgasms and eating vegetarian chili and such. I don't know why souls aren't deposited in all of the people. Maybe there's a limited supply. Okay, here's where it gets scary. The Ella recycle the planet once in a while, which basically means everybody dies, but the world goes on and a new crop of mammals, potential soul receptacles, eventually replace them. In order to avoid this spading over, as Applewhite called it, you have to follow an older member, the representative, him, Jesus, to get on board a spaceship that comes down to round up the faithful, as it were. And you can't just follow them part-time. You've got to go whole hog, abandon your family, friends, home, possessions, desires, Tupperware, dress shirts, orgasms, vegetarian chili, all of it. And you've got to cleave to them like a polyester shirt dried with no dryer sheet cleaves to a torso. That might sound pretty good, actually, if you think everything you've got is shit and you don't know what to do about it. The number of people who actually go all the way is very small. In Jesus' case, I guess, it was just the 12 apostles, and maybe not even all of them. Jesus was killed by the Luciferians, basically fallen angels or members of the Ella that got a bee in their bonnet about teamwork or some such thing and decided to become evil overlords of Earth. They are responsible for all earthly things like materialism and greed and the government and fucking and dress shirts and Tupperware and vegetarian chili. Even religion, in the sense that their versions of religion are perverted to keep the focus primarily on the earthly kingdom. Basically, they are the gods that Christians are worshiping. Got all that? Great. Oh, I almost forgot a bit of good news. So, if you miss the bus, so to speak, spaceship in this case, all hope is not lost. Yes, your meat suit will die, but your soul will live on and you'll have a chance to maybe catch the next representative and give up all your stuff in life to follow them. Hooray! So, Applewhite's soul deposit was the same soul deposit that had inhabited Jesus and was here again to reap a new crop. But this time, he came with his boss slash father, God, who inhabited his pal Bonnie Lou Nettles, and the rest is history. Let's move on to the next verse. 4.
These are the two olive trees and the two candlesticks standing before the God of Earth.
That seems like gibberish to me. Maybe something got garbled in translation. Next. 5.
And if any man will hurt them, fire proceedeth out of their mouth and devoureth their enemies. And if any man will hurt them, he must in this manner be killed.
More gibberish. Neither Applewhite nor Nettles ever breathed fire, as far as I can tell. 6.
These have power to shut heaven, that it rain not in the days of their prophecy, and have power over waters to turn them to blood, and to smite the earth with all plagues as often as they will.
Pass. Next. 7.
And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them, and kill them.
Okay, now we're talking sense again. The beast is clearly established organized religion, and the government under the influence of religion. Luciferians, as we've established. And this totally happened, but maybe not in the way you'd imagined, because Luciferians are very sneaky. They basically killed the two in the most devastating way imaginable, by completely ignoring them. At the very beginning of their ministry, the two imagined they would be killed in no time at all. That, in retrospect, seems an unreasonable expectation for two middle-aged folks that put up some weird posters, had a few meetings, and operated a New Age shop. The government is not to be trusted, of course, but they typically don't massacre folks for selling crystals, especially white folks. Eventually, they shifted their teachings a bit, as they would often do. You've got to be flexible in this line of business, to tell folks that they wouldn't have to die to get to where they wanted to go. They could enter the spaceship with their meat suits. They also may have mentioned that they were immortal. They recruited their followers, their class as they called them, through means previously mentioned. Meetings and flyers, and later, newspaper ads, videos, and the internet. This was remarkably successful, considering what they were selling and how unpleasant they made the whole thing sound, what with the lack of dress shirts and vegetarian chili, etc. In 1975, after a meeting in Oregon, they'd managed to recruit around 100 people and made the news for the first time when all of those people proceeded to vanish. Walter Cronkite talked about it on his broadcast. Really, they had not so much vanished as gone underground, and not so much gone underground as stopped answering phone calls. They crisscrossed the United States in dumpy cars with and without tea and dough, as the two were now most often referring to themselves, occasionally rendezvousing at campground. It was all pretty loose-knit, their teachings vague and cryptic, the connection to their followers often only psychic, which is to say, probably non-existent. They paired their followers in groups of two, often with someone they might be attracted to, in order to create conflict to be overcome, i.e., the stress of not causing each other to have orgasms, and sent them out into the world with little money and minimal instruction, quite similar to how I spent most of my 20s, that is to say, poor and confused, unable to have orgasms caused by all the people I would have liked to have caused them. Occasionally, they'd find bags of food and have to piece together messages from the two, real and imagined, from the labels. Or they'd see posters and find them that way. Or they'd just stumble upon each other. If this doesn't really seem to make sense, it's because it doesn't. We don't know exactly what happened in this period because it wasn't well documented and no one really seemed to know what they were doing, tea and dough included. A few members came and went over the next couple of years. More went than came for obvious reasons. And eventually the two decided it was time to get down to business with the class they had. To do that, they'd all need to be in the same place. At first, that meant another campground, where they tried to build a compound out of old tires. But when that turned out to be too much work, they utilized one member's trust fund and some meager income from working odd jobs to begin renting houses, changing locations every once in a while to evade detection. This is when the belief system really began to formalize, to the point where they had instructions on how big to make pancakes. But then, in the early 80s, Bonnie Nettles got cancer, and in 1985, she died, ascending back to where she came from. Lucky her. This presented Marshall Applewhite with a problem, though. The two were supposed to be immortal. The whole clan was supposed to board the spaceship with their bodies via a laser beam or some futuristic-looking stairs or maybe teleportation. So he shifted again. They'd have to die to get on the spaceship. Back to the original Bible verse. Nettles, he said, had been brought back to the Ella and was now piloting the spacecraft that would pick them up. She told him this psychically. and they would all have to abandon their meat suits to join her. Suicide, though, was still out of the question. The Luciferians would take care of it. This, I guess, sounded A-OK to the class. By the early 90s, it seemed inevitable that the government slash organized religion slash Luciferians would over-intervene and take care of the abandonment of their meat suits for them, violently as they do. Historically, people calling themselves Jesus have not been treated well by either of these entities. David Koresh and his Branch Davidians had just been burned alive after a full-on military standoff. Was Koresh a creep? Yes. But the world is full of creeps, and there were kids in there. This is a semi-unrelated tangent, but it bears noting that the US government sanctioned the burning alive of children. This isn't uncommon, see all wars, but it was exceptional in that these particular children were white US citizens, which Americans usually care about. Anyway, for one reason or another, the government didn't seem to give two shits about Heaven's Gate. They were just too small and weird, maybe. And there was a distinct lack of ambition. They weren't particularly aggressive in their expansion efforts. Just a meeting here and there, some wildly wordy posters, a few videos that look like transmissions to the Starship Enterprise from a hostile alien civilization, and, later on, a cryptic website. Also of note was the lack of sex. The typical religious cult includes at least some diddling. Heaven's Gate was so anti-diddling that several of the men, including Applewhite, traveled to Mexico to be castrated. This, I think, is an overlooked reason for why no one cared what they were doing. It wasn't sexy. These dudes didn't even have dongs, which I suppose some people might find very sexy. But the lack of hostility presented Applewhite with yet another problem. How would they reascend to the Ella if no one was willing to brutally murder them? They'd have to do it themselves. So they did. On March 19th and 20th, 1997, 39 members of Heaven's Gate, including Applewhite, killed themselves by ingesting pudding laced with poison and drinking vodka in three shifts, all wearing identical clothes with a Heaven's Gate away team patch on the shoulders and draped in purple shrouds. Next verse. 8.
And their dead bodies shall lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified.
This happened too, kind of. If one considers television the modern-day equivalent of the streets of Sodom, which I guess one may as well. Heaven's Gate was all over the news. You probably remember it. If not, thanks for listening, youngster or recently reacclimated forest recluse. Happy to have you here. 9.
And they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3 days and a half, and shall not suffer their dead bodies to be put in graves.
Pass. 10.
And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them and make merry, and shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets tormented them that dwelt on the earth.
Tormented is a strong word, but the rest of the world was pretty quick to make a joke out of all of this. Sure, 39 people died, but it is a little funny if you look at it in the right way. Everything is, except for Bill Ingvall, of course. People are still making a joke of it. I'm doing that right now, sort of. In my defense, I did watch all of the group's exit interviews, videos they made in the days prior to the suicides. They're all on YouTube and utterly fascinating, if more than a little morbid. And I have to say, all of the members seemed completely aware of what they were about to do and happy about it. Not to mention unsettlingly sane and in many cases, lighthearted and even joyful. If they could laugh about it, why can't we? Next verse. 11.
And after 3 days and a half, the spirit of life from God entered into them, and they stood upon their feet, and great fear fell upon them which saw them.
Pass. 12.
And they heard a great voice from heaven saying unto them, come up hither, and they ascended up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them.
Listen, who knows? Maybe? So this part and the last are basically mirror images of the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, which is where this whole thing began, which I guess means we've come full circle and should wrap up this section of the show. Let's, you and I, break for commercial, and when we come back, I'll see if I can cook up my own religion. Stay tuned.
Heaven passes! Get your heaven passes!
Did you say heaven passes?
That's right, ma'am. Heaven passes.
As in passes that entitle you entrance into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more!
Not sure there's much more to tell, ma'am.
Well, there clearly is. Is this Jewish heaven?
There's only one heaven, ma'am.
Are there Jewish people there?
What? Want to buy a heaven pass?
I still have a lot of questions.
Such as?
Geez, where do I start?
Haven't got all day, ma'am. Lots of heaven passes to sell.
But who is God? Like, who's in charge of heaven?
Dunno.
What authority do you have to sell these passes into heaven?
Fully licensed, ma'am.
This is very frustrating.
Heaven passes! Get your heaven passes! Are you tired of shifty heaven pass salesmen giving you the old runaround? Who are these guys anyway, and what deity have they been authorized by? When you get a heaven pass, you should know who you're buying it from and what heaven it is that you're buying it for. Well, I've got some answers for you. You're buying it from your old pal Jim Krakowski, and you're buying it for whichever heaven in which you'd like to spend all of eternity. Hi, I'm Jim Krakowski, and my Jim Crow omni-denominational heaven passes will get you into whichever heaven you like. Guaranteed! I've prayed to every deity you can imagine, and they've universally agreed that my heaven passes are the only ones on the market that can absolutely get you into any heaven without any red tape. How great is that? Whether you're a Muslim or a Jew or a Buddhist or a Satanist or a Hindu or a Raelian or a Catholic or a Baha'i or a Druze or a Rasta or a Jain or an Animist or a Druid or a Wiccan or a Pagan or even a Lutheran, my heaven passes will get you to where you want to go for a low, low price. To get yours, just pray on it. Your guy or gal will let me know, and I'll be in touch. So, pray now to get your Jim Crow heaven pass. It'll get you into heaven.
Welcome back, friend. I am your host, Esemi LL, formerly known as Reed Messerschmidt. It's so good to have you here. Praise Odor. I can't smell you, per se, of course, but I sense your smell, and it's wonderful. You may be slightly confused right now, but I promise by Odor's name, this will all become very clear shortly. Suffice it to say for now that I have some astounding and wonderful information to share with you, my friend. Allow me to begin at the beginning. I smelled a revelation. This is how it came to pass, yea, verily. I, Esemi LL, your brother and companion in the sniffing and huffing and perfect stink that are ours in Odor, was in the city of Fargo because that's where my meat body lives. On a Tuesday in October, I was in the spirit, and I smelled behind me a powerful smell like the putrid stench of a delicious pickled egg. And a voice in my head did say, "Record in a really terrific podcast what you see, and send it to wherever podcasts are available. to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and your own wonderful website, www.theirrationallyexuberant.com. I turned around to see the source of the smell, and when I turned, I saw 7 golden incense holders. And among the incense holders was someone like a nose of man, its nostrils flaring gloriously, with a golden sash around the base of the bridge. The hair in the nose was white like wool, as white as snow, and it emitted a snuffling like the rustle of a trillion blades of grass. Its feet, the nose had feet, were like bronze glowing in a furnace, and the nose itself emitted a scent like 1,000 oranges being eaten by 1,000 hot girls. In its right hand, it had hands. It held 7 stars, and coming out of one nostril was a sharp double-edged sword. Its skin was like the sun shining in all its brilliance. When I saw her, I assumed the nose was a lady, I guess because I'm a feminist. I fell at her feet as though dead. Then she placed her right hand on me and emitted a new order. Like bananas but better, which seemed to say, "Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last. I am the ambassador of Odor. I smell, and now look. I smell forever and ever, and I hold the keys of the universe and salvation. Podcast, therefore, what you have seen, what is now, and what will take place later. The mystery of the 7 stars that you saw in my right hand and of the 7 golden incense holders is this. The 7 stars are the essences at the center of existence, and the 7 incense burners are just for show." This is what I saw. Praise be to Odor and his emissary, the very large nose. Thus begins the beginning. At creation's beginning were 2 types, meat and essence. The meats, man and woman, but mostly man, were vain and curious and obsessed with their genitals and spread out into the universe to found their own planets and build their own creations. The essences, smell, taste, love, joy, thought, bitter sweetness, and tingles, stayed at the heart of creation and lived in perfect harmony and peace and bliss. The meat had a fatal flaw. They were all manic depressives, and those that didn't destroy themselves and their creations in wild manias often became sad and took their own lives, leaving their creations to flounder. The negative psychic waves from all of this unhappy mania, death, and floundering reverberated through the universe and disrupted the peace of the essences. So they began sending delegates to the beleaguered planets, step gods, to gently push the meat creations in a more positive direction, to expand their essence ways to encompass all of the universe, to end the negative psychic waves and get some peace and quiet in the universe. The God of Earth was one of these meat gods. He is the God of the Christian and Jewish holy books, and everything in the Old Testament is true, right up until the Great Flood. God didn't destroy the world via flood. He committed suicide because he was sad, because his creation wasn't very good and had turned against him. All the other gods were laughing at him. He was a shit god and let his vanity and genitals get the better of him. The destruction of the flood is what happens when a planet's god dies. Chaos. There's no one there to turn off the rain once it starts. So essence intervention became necessary as the screams of God's damned creations were super annoying.
Odor quickly replaced him and got things under control, turned off the rain, toweled up the place, and swirled among the meat people. There was no smell before this. Odor brought it with him. Humans had noses, but they were strictly ornamental. God had put them there for the time when he'd give humans the idea for glasses. Odor planted an aroma-sensing microchip in the noses of all the remaining humans that encoded itself into human DNA so that it would be present in all offspring. The microchip is postage stamp-sized because Odor has a fun sense of whimsy and considers every smell a letter from him to us. Satan was still around and not happy about any of this. He'd expected to inherit the earth when God died. So he invented false smells to confuse the humans and prevent them from receiving Odor. So sneaky. When the righteous die, their souls are wafted up by the stink of Odor and encircle the earth, causing global warming. When the earth is destroyed by this warming, they will be released and collectively travel to Garflax 13, the center of all creation. This occurs all over the universe according to the essence presiding over each abandoned planet. Eventually, once all of the devout have been assembled and the meat planets have perished, all of existence will be a paradise without any of the bad vibes mucking things up. The essences will recombine with far greater masses, will expand to encompass all, and the universe will be perfect. But not all will heed Odor, of course. Some will be deceived by false smells. Some just won't get the memo and will have themselves buried and will be drawn into Earth's core where the original Satan still operates hell. Eventually, they will perish with the physical Earth. So ends the telling of the origins. These are the strong suggestions of Odor and shall henceforth be the pillars of what I'm going to call exuberism. 1. All smells are good smells, except for false smells, which are very bad. 2. Keep your personal odor neutral to more clearly accept the word of Odor. 3. Creating false smells is an abomination unto Odor. 4. A breath through the mouth is a wasted breath. 5. Smell all there is to smell, for the smells are messages from Odor. 6. Beware germs and allergens. They block the word of Odor. 7. Get out of the sea, you buffoon. You don't belong there. 8. Heed the super smeller, for she is a prophet. 9. Do not bury the dead, for underground their smells cannot ascend to their place in the atmosphere. And finally, a proverb. Do not rush from the porta potty. It has much to teach you. So ends the word smells of Odor. And that is the good news I have to bring to you, my friend. I am so, so honored and humbled to be the emissary of Odor. Humbled is the wrong word. Let's say proud and deserving, even boastful. For 'twas my greatness that made Odor choose me, after all. I'd have to be a real bonehead to be humble after that, right? And now, after much meditation and sniffing, I have unearthed more of the word smell of Odor. Fleshed things out a bit, made some clarifications, written a hymn. Let me share them with you now, my friend in stank. How best to do this? Perhaps I shall walk you through the day of a righteous adherent of Odor. Something the Christian Bible and any other holy book fails to do, and maybe why the adherents of other lesser religions, lesser than exuberism, not Christianity, all seem to be so confused. More great news. Your days of confusion and questions about what to do from moment to moment are a thing of the past. 8:30 a.m. Rise from your bed with a deep inhalation. No alarm is necessary, for your body shall be so attuned to smells that the unique stink of 8:30 will rouse you from your slumber. Throw away all of your clocks, come to think of it. The nose is Odor's clock, and so shall it be yours. Keep breathing deeply, always through your nose. The mouth should never open, but to eat and kiss and spread the truth whenever spreading it through aroma isn't possible. Let the smells you smell fill your mind. Peel the Breathe Right strip from the bridge of your nose and replace it with a fresh one. These indispensable little contraptions will keep your sinuses open to all of Odor's wonder. Just smell for a while. Smell the air. Smell yourself. Really get into all of those nooks and crannies of your body. Don't be shy. Get your nose right in there. Let Odor tell you about yourself. 9 a.m. Once you have smelled all that Odor has to tell you, though, to be utterly truthful, as a mortal you can never really smell all that Odor has to tell you, make your way to the bath and cleanse yourself with only water. Soaps are a false smell and, as such, are of the devil and abhorrent to Odor. As you bathe, sing this song, but only in your head or if others are around to share in the good news. Otherwise, keep breathing through your nose. Oh, Odor, lead my nose to thee. Your stink is the better part of me. May your musk be in my nostrils now and forevermore, till the day that I am one with you, Odor. You sent to us a prophet, name of Semi-Yellel. He's handsome and he'll save us all from hell. And you came to us from far away when our meek God was no more. And for that I am so grateful, Odor. Lead my nose to thee. Your stink is the better part of me. May your musk be in my nostrils now and forevermore, till the day that I am one with you, Odor. Etc. It goes on in a kind of never-ending loop. 10 a.m. Exit the bath, towel off, put on your simple, neutral-colored, cotton, one-piece suit with a picture of the very large nose embroidered on the back. If you are a super smeller or a prophet like myself, you will instead wear extremely fancy, brightly colored clothes made of silk with the very large nose bedazzled on the back. Go outside and sit down to meditate. The location doesn't matter. The road, the sidewalk, the grass. Odor has messages for us everywhere. Just so long as you are not underwater or overwhelmed by false scents. Once exuberism takes off, we will have a massive compound, of course, with a designated meditation area, not to mention community baths. Sit in quiet reflection, breathing deeply and steadily through your nose for 3 hours. Odor has much to tell you. 1 p.m. Sustenance. You may be wondering what you should eat as an exuberist. I'll only say this. As with all things, let odor be your guide. We may move towards an aroma-only diet in the future, but for now, just do as the wise old sugar parrot says and follow your nose. 2 p.m. Another 2 hours of meditation. 4 p.m. It's time to spread the word and make some cash. Those simple, neutral-colored cotton one-piece suits with a picture of the very large nose embroidered on the back aren't going to pay for themselves. Here's what you'll do. Go door to door to tell folks about the good news and sell them Exuberism brand Breathe Right strips, very large nose hats, t-shirts that say, "Odor stinks and I love it," and simple, neutral-colored, cotton, one-piece suits with a picture of the very large nose embroidered on the back. These are all very reasonably priced, and your 10% commission will keep you reasonably well-fed and potentially sheltered from now until the compound is built. You should be knocking on doors until at least midnight. Some folks might be upset that you've woken them from their slumber, but their sleep haze can make them more susceptible to the good news, and they'll be thrilled once they find out why you're actually there. 12:30. One more hour of meditation, and then off to bed. All praise Odor! Well, friend, so ends the lesson for today. I know that there are many questions left unanswered, and I'll be back to share with you the further good news of Odor very soon. Join me, won't you, in once more singing the praises of our great god, Odor. Smell you later. Oh, Odor, lead my nose to thee. Your stink is the better part of me. May your musk be in my nostrils now and forevermore, till the day that I am one with you, Odor. You sent to us a prophet, name of Ezemiel. He's handsome and he'll save us all from hell. And you came to us from far away when our meek God was no more. And for that I am so grateful, Odor. Lead my nose to thee. Your stink is the better part of me. May your musk be in my nostrils now and forevermore, till the day that I am one.